So this is Application Paranoia, episode 12. So welcome again to Application Paranoia, our podcast about application security, DevSecOps, and AppScan. Twice a month, we aim to bring you some of the best technical insights, assorted facts, and the latest news from HCL AppScan. Our underlying mission is to deliver continuous application security to the masses. Ooh. I'm Colin Bell, and I have with me yet again Rob Cuddy and Chris Dewar. Hey, Rob, how are you?
I'm doing great. Colin, how are you doing?
I'm doing fine. You're having all sorts of technical problems today, though, are you?
Yeah, a few here and there, but, you know, it's par for the course, right? We just kind of roll with it and make it work. I'm just happy to be here.
Yep. On this week's episode, we're going to be talking to Chris Nowak, who is HCL's Software Director of DevOps and Advisory and Adoptions. Look forward to that. And we also have, as always, we have Chris. So, Chris, how are you?
I'm doing good. How are you?
I'm fab. You know, it's funny because we're all over the place in terms of time zones. So this is late at night for me. So it's
this is almost 5 o'clock for me.
10 to 10 at night. You know, so it's kind of fun.
Only about 2 o'clock in the afternoon here. So
everyone's everywhere. Yeah. So. I've actually had some time off as well, so it's kind of good. I actually did a staycation.
Staycation.
Yeah, myself and the wife, we went to Druid's Glen, which is a golf course in Wicklow.
So ball golf?
No golfing was done.
Oh, you didn't even do disc golf?
No golfing. Not even miniature golf.
You went to a golf course? You didn't golf?
No. It's a hotel and spa, so just relax and enjoy the nice scenery and stuff like that.
Is miniature disc golf a thing?
Turns out, no, it is not.
Turns out.
How would that work?
I really don't know. But
trying to throw it somewhat further than 10 feet.
Yeah, exactly. That would be really funny, though.
Things would have to be made out of iron or something just to have enough weight.
Make it out of iron.
Yeah. Probably disc golf? No.
That's right. Good. Take all of those 10-pound weights from the local gym and turn them in.
Oh, go long. No.
In relation to my running capabilities, you'll be pleased to know that I've surpassed myself and gone past 6 months of continuous running.
Wow.
So in honor of continuous running security?
Continuous running security. But it's what's particularly funny, I use Strava a lot, and on Strava I typically run a different route every day because I'd get bored, and I try to do pictures. I managed to create locally. I can create a snake sort of picture. We're running. Yeah, you know, you get a nice. You look at the map afterwards, and it looks like a snake. You know, so yeah. I was overly impressed. There's a cyclist in Belgium who did 277 kilometers. And drew a beer glass.
Nice.
That's fantastic.
Nice. Like
you deserve an award. That's awesome.
He literally drew a Duvel beer glass and logo. And it's just awesome. He even had the froth of the beer on the top of the glass. You know? But for what was particularly good, the brewery then awarded him with a new bike and new glasses for the beer and everything. It's just brilliant.
Wow.
So cycling can't get you anything.
Yes. So now all our listeners are going to be looking at their local maps and trying to find their favorite vendors and seeing what logos they can go in and
make a Strava map out of it.
Well, you guys might remember there was a series of commercials not too long ago where it was you'd see this guy, you know, sort of half jogging up the street and he'd come to a fence and then he'd turn abruptly and go in a different direction. And then he would do the same thing in front of like a drugstore. He'd go halfway down a block and then kind of turn and come back. And the commercial ended with him getting home and he would print out the run that he just did and give it to his wife. And it was either things like a heart or a flower or, you know, I love you running through the streets and stuff. And so she, it ended with, you know, you could see this wall where she had just put them all up, and it was his way of just leaving little sort of love notes to her every day on his runs. So I thought that was kind of cool.
You know, people like that need to keep their secrets to themselves because they make the rest of us look bad. I'm just saying. I'm not going to ever do that.
Like, illusion or...
Exactly. But yeah. I mean, you've obviously seen the picture of the glass, but it is worth looking up what this guy did on his cycle. It took him 2 attempts to get it, but
that is insane.
It's pretty awesome. Yeah. You know?
So I had a really fun thing last night where, I work with a lot of junior high students, and we got a bunch of the leaders together for kind of an event and just planning stuff. But one of our guys was celebrating his 30th year of working with students. And so it got me thinking about some of the things that had happened in that guy's time frame. And so just some of the fun little things that I realized in sort of researching some of that was that he's been working with junior high students longer than Taylor Swift has been alive. And he, in the time that he has, I know, I thought that was pretty good, right? But the thing that actually really jumped out at me, and I was initially trying to think, okay, well, how many people have done things like walked on the moon or whatever since then? But there haven't actually been that many moonwalkers in the last couple of decades. But what did surprise me was since this gentleman started in working with students, 21 different countries have launched their first person into space. And it was astonishing to me to realize how many people and how many countries have actually done that now that we just don't hear about. And even places like Cuba, just launching people, you know, into space and stuff like that. And I was like, 21 different countries.
Did they all come back?
Yeah, that's a real question.
Are they just getting launched back?
Yeah. I don't know if it's a giant slingshot or a, you know, manned spacecraft. But yeah.
To claim the achievement, you have to bring them back safely as well.
Exactly. But yeah, obviously a lot of change. And this guy, you know, obviously survived leg warmers and neon and, you know, the hair bands and Debbie Gibson and all kinds of other things. So it's a really good
Google of smartphones, etc. You want to feel
exactly
old? We're older than exactly. Google. What?
Yeah. Exactly.
Oh man, for me, one of my favorite passions is conspiracy theories. One of my very favorite things to do is believe every word that's said and just go into that world just for a little bit. Like, why would you say this? And what if it is real? So one of the things that comes up is, of course, and I believe this because it's from, you know, YouTube, a highly reputable source. I trust everything on YouTube, right?
It never lies. YouTube never lies.
Never lies. It's always true. But apparently someone found a Nazi coin, which in itself isn't remarkable, except this one's from 2039.
Really?
What?
What?
We're not even in 2039 yet. So either it's from the future or from a parallel universe. Oh, the possibilities are so fun. Or it's just somebody that made a coin and stuck it somewhere in Mexico and let somebody else find it, which is more likely the case. But what if it was true? What a wild thought. There's a universe where the Nazis won? Damn. They have coins that came here? How? What a wild thought that is.
It hasn't come back yet, yeah.
It's like, well, at least all we have is the coins and not, you know, their stupid nonsense, but
damn, wow.
What a weird thought. A 2039 coin that happened to be from the Nazis.
Only on the flat Earth, yeah?
Only on the flat Earth. Parallel universe where they haven't fallen off the edge, exactly. But see how much fun it is, conspiracy theories? They're just, oh, you go into them just for a little bit to think about if this was true.
So there was a tweet I saw from a guy who said he got kicked out of the Flat Earth social distancing group on Facebook because he asked whether or not the social distancing had pushed everybody over the edge.
I saw that. That was hysterical.
I thought that was pretty funny.
So that's let's move on to AppScan news. So in AppScan news, we did all our major releases just recently. So our 10.02 part of our last episode. Got a couple of little things with ASOC, and I know, Chris, there's more exciting things to come. So maybe you can give us a little update on what's happening in the world of ASOC.
Yeah, I mean, we've got quite a bit in the works. It hasn't been pushed out yet, but it's likely to be pushed out next week. So if you're hearing this, you'll probably hear about all the great things we're going to put in that on the next episode. But for now, we do have IaaS monitoring for .NET, which is a pretty big deal. Used to be just Java, as I understand it, but now it's .NET also. So woohoo, IaaS is growing in spades, which is nice.
Yeah, interested to see how some of the customers react to that and how the sort of results they might get. So what else is in there?
Well, you know, just the old quality of life improvements that everybody likes, the ability to download logs now, which is, you know, helpful for SAST. CSV reports, which is nice, are now in the ISO format, which is an interesting call out by us, but I guess it's an important thing. So
someone obviously wanted it. Yeah,
so this is very important. Our date formats are now following the ISO 8601 standard. So there you go.
Well, good. So we're a bit light on news, but you're saying that next episode we'll have some exciting new stuff to look forward to. So
quite a bit, yeah.
Cool. Look forward to that. And in terms of things like Code Sweep and things like that, how's that progressing? Have you heard any information in relation to that?
Yeah, it's kind of on its own track, so it goes into its own little world, but it's the same as before. They're separating, you know, all the rules into their own categories so that it makes a little bit more sense. When you look at JavaScript, for example, there's like 6 or 7 languages all in JavaScript. So they're separating those out to make it a little bit easier to navigate through the rules and which ones you want to enable, which ones you want to disable, so on and so forth. But functionally, I don't know if anyone here has tried it, but it's pretty slick at what it does. You don't have to do anything. You just have to keep coding and save your file. And there you go. It's going to figure out whether you added something bad or good.
Excellent.
It's free. There's no reason not to get it. But yeah, VS Code, look for Code Sweep in the marketplace and boom, just install it. I was a little bit surprised by how easy it was to use, install, and interact with. I was shocked. Right? We build it, so I mean, I don't build it, but you know, our team builds it. So yeah, it's pretty cool.
Yeah, and if people want to dive in a little bit on some of these things too, right? Our AppScan Tuesday friends did a whole session on September 8th, kind of outlining some of the capabilities around 10.02 and some of these things that we're talking about here. So that's worth listening to.
As we progress, we're going to go to another best practice by Chris.
Yeah.
What do you have for us today?
It's probably my favorite injection technique, OS injection, where you can run whatever the crap you want to on the affected code, wherever it's installed. Bad.
So we have a multiple of them. What would we call it? What's our collective noun for OS injections?
Thanks. This is more like a plethora of OS injections.
A plethora. Yeah, we can accept that. Yeah.
So, I mean, really, really bad stuff. You want to avoid this at all costs. And the thing that's the most frustrating about OS injection is it's you almost have to open your door and say, please come in, with a sign outside that says, we're not home, for you to get into this position. I mean, some of the basic things you can do to protect yourself aren't done. You're letting people say which command they want to run, what the parameters should be, giving them, you know, command separators or allowing those in your code. It's just, it's so easy to avoid, and it's out there. It's insane to me. It's one of those where I don't think this should be a vulnerability anymore, but you know, Struts had a flaw, a pretty famous flaw, that was remote command execution, where they would send in an extended or a sort of not finished content type so that it would go to the parser to see where the end is, and that parser would go through another framework that generated or looked at the command, and if it was, you know, command /c some command, it would run it. It was crazy. like absolutely insane to me, like how that was actually a thing. So yeah, it's one of those kinds of vulnerabilities that you really do open your door and say, please come in. Anytime you use, you know, like a process command, you shouldn't be using processes in your code if there's an analog in the code base. You know, if you're trying to type in process command ls-la this directory, why aren't you using, you know, files list all files instead? I don't understand why you're not using the analog and you're running the command. Like, if you look out there everywhere, almost all of the most common things you're going to need to be doing in code has an analog. It has code that's designed specifically so you don't have to run the process on the local system. It also tends to make your code a little bit less portable, which is not desirable. So yeah, avoid running processes at all costs. Just don't do it. Now, if you have to, and there are cases where you have to, there are defenses you can use. And certainly OWASP, our favorite place, goes into this. The OS command prevention cheat sheet kind of goes over what command separators are, what to look out for. There's some that are universal to both, like the pipe and the and symbol. You know, you can concatenate commands on a command line. So you can imagine what happens if you pass in whatever you want and you know, cat /etsy/password to something like that, and you'll get all of the password entries. And that's just not a good thing. You don't want that. Or, you know, send mail to somebody, give me all the Etsy password files. And there we go. I've got access to your system. So watch out for pipes. Watch out for ands. If you're letting users control any of the information, it has to be the argument for the command. And you should be using parameterized commands at all costs and checking each of these parameters does not have, you know, these command separator things in them. It's a pretty easy blacklist to make. Just don't allow it. But yeah, really use the OS analog if it has one. Avoid processors at all costs if you can. And if you can't, get rid of everything that's not a command string. And even beyond that, if you can whitelist what you expect, like if it should just be alphanumeric, you should be making sure it's just alphanumeric. And if it's not, you should be throwing an exception or getting rid of the character that's not, whichever you need to use for your particular use case, that sort of thing. Just do the right thing. Stop opening the door with a sign that says, we're not home, please rob me.
Yeah, it's amazing how often OS injections still get found. You know,
it's crazy to me. It's just insane to me. Although the struts vulnerability wasn't, you know, this situation where it was a process command that didn't do proper validation. It was a framework that would run an arbitrary command because you told it to run an arbitrary command based on its interpolation. So technically you gave it the process runner to run with the bad command inside of it as part of, you know, the content type string. So even in things like that, which can do interpolation or whatever you want to call it, where it just analyzes the data you're giving it in Java eval, for example, or Python eval, horribly, horribly, horribly dangerous API, because it can actually make code, it can make functions, and it can call those functions to do things you weren't expecting when all you really wanted to do was say, you know, 1 + 1 = 2 or something like that. It's just, oh, it's crazy to me how many open doors there are on the bottom floor. It's a zero trust. If you're going to use a command and you're going to go outside of your code to do something, you really do need to think very carefully about why you need to do it.
Yeah, for sure.
And for the love of God, hard code the damn command you're going to use. Don't let them say, I don't want to run command C. I want to run, I don't know, rm-rf/. That would be my initial shell or whatever it is.
Hey guys, this week we are delighted to have with us our director for DevOps and adoption, and it's Chris Nowak. And Chris has got a wealth of experience working in the DevOps space, having spent a couple of decades working with some of the larger banks in the U.S., like Wells Fargo and Bank of America. And he's got a ton of experience implementing successful programs that bring DevOps efficiencies to teams, getting people to collaborate, getting people to understand the impact, and really driving the business bottom line through leveraging software well throughout the DevOps pipeline. So we're delighted to have you with us, Chris, and would love to continue the conversation. So how are things going on your end, being the director of DevOps here?
Hey, thanks, Rob. Thanks, everybody, for having me here. It's great. We have a very large opportunity and ability here to go out and help folks. And so, you know, Rob, as you saw in the, or said in the beginning, you know, my background actually was in the corporate side of America. So, yeah. So, you know, the corporate side of America, it was always great, only because, you know, you had this opportunity to try to help groups come together, and I'm seeing it again here. So I'm very happy with it.
What are some of the things that you're trying to instill into the HCL business, and what would you see is some of the things that you're hoping are going to, you know, come about from your experience into HCL?
You know, one of the things I think I learned early on, and I think a lot of us do that have been in technology a long time, is that it's less about technology and more about the business. In fact, there's a quote we like to say, right? DevOps is not a technology problem, it's a business problem. And, you know, one of the things that I learned early on was you can have okay technology, but this attention that you want to give and the service that you want to provide to your clients. And when I was on the other side, it would have been the development teams that were in the organizations that I considered them my clients. That high attention to service and making sure they're having the best experience, turns out that was the winner. It was always the winner for everything. And so it's not that HCL isn't doing it, but I think, you know, to answer the question would be to bring that kind of a mindset and bring it even more with what HCL is doing, and to really look at our clients and our prospects and our business partners and say, how do we really give you really good service, help you use the products the right way to your success? So it's sort of a service mindset, I think, if anything, or a client relationship mindset.
Yeah, no, in the DevOps world, we keep hearing this term DevSecOps, which is, you know, plugging security into the fat middle of DevOps. Right. So I'm very curious what, you know, 50,000 foot overview, what your take on that word actually means in reality, in practice.
Wow, you know, I love the question, actually. So those of us that have been doing this before DevOps was actually a word, you've heard this variation. It went from first it was DevOps, and then it was Biz DevOps, and then Dev Test Ops, and then DevSecOps. You know, the fact of the matter is, I think if you're one of these folks that thinks holistically around DevOps, security has always been part of it. Testing's always been part of it. Risk and audit has always been part of it. Sometimes when you have, I phrase it as DevSecOps is a specific implementation of DevOps with a focus on security. That's kind of the way I talk about it. And that's okay, right? You can have all of these ideas that come together to solve security-centric problems. You could say the same thing about risk and audit. You know, working in the banks, we never did anything that didn't involve a conversation with risk and audit. And very often, that was actually helping us sort of promote the idea of this DevOps platform or philosophy, because we said, well, look, we have regulations. Let's not pretend they don't exist. How do we help the regulations, like make them less onerous or less restrictive, so that we can let our application teams and our operations teams do better what they have to do? And so the idea of DevSecOps, I like the word because it says, look, we're thinking about security here, but in a different way, I almost don't like it, because the idea of DevOps really should be all of those things. And then if you try to string it together, pretty soon you're going to get something like DevSec, Biz, Test, Risk Ops, right? And that it gets a little much.
Should just be called DevOps.
Right. And that's not correct either, but, you know, it is what it is.
Yeah. And one of the curious things about DevSecOps, if I can use that phrase now, is scanning, right? Is to plug in, sure. Oh, let's do a whole bunch of scanning. But it's more than that, isn't it? It's not just scanning. What do you think is beyond just scanning that you need to think about or you need to worry about?
Yeah, you know, I'm not a security expert, but, you know, of course you're scanning at multiple levels, whether it's, you know, your dynamic or your static scanning. I do think, you know, when you think about, like, DevOps is really kind of a philosophy, right? You want to get to a proactive level as well. So how do you incorporate the proactive pieces of security? Like, so you're not reacting or scanning code, but you're actually out there removing risks before they become risks. So, you know, I think if you were going to say, hey, where do I really want to take security from this idea of an end-to-end DevOps idea? It would be those types of things, right? How do you incorporate, you know, measuring your surfaces or whatever it is to mitigate risk, is security risks.
Do other considerations like making sure you have the right MD5 or SHA-1 calculation for my final bits and all of that stuff?
Yeah, I mean, it can be anything really small and technical to, you know, what are the bigger ideas that you want to promote. So, and sometimes it's just the visibility, right? Maybe it isn't the scan itself, but who gets the scan and who sees it so that they can make a correlation in their area. And so taking those ideas of, here, this bit of security information is useful to somebody else, you know, that could be critical too.
and making sure they start fixing things? Or would you call making sure they're fixing things part of the purview of their responsibility and quote unquote tossing it back over the wall, whatever wall might exist? Because I don't know. I don't think any team out there is doing all the pieces, the build, the security, the development, the testing. There's no one person that's doing it all. I don't buy it. I don't even know if there's a single group in a company that's doing it all. That's just insanity to me.
No, I agree with you. You know, I actually had a conversation last night with a friend of mine I used to work with, and this idea of a full stack developer, this is a unicorn to me.
Beyond a unicorn.
If there's one or two in the organization, they're probably the chief architect, and they're not writing code anymore, right? Because it takes a long time to say I'm an expert in these three things. And so I don't think there's really such a thing as a full stack expert or developer or whatever it is. What I do think is there's a full stack team. And so that's where you make sure that I have a security expert on the team and an ops expert and, you know, a testing expert. And that's okay. The team is strong together. And I think that's really the much more affordable construct, because there are just very, very few people that are walking around with 50 years of experience to talk in these, you know, in the three or four silos. So,
right. So Chris, just kind of piggybacking off that for a second, you know, we know one of the three ways, right, is accelerating those feedback loops back so that, you know, as that testing is going on. So what have you seen as some of the ways to get feedback to people that matter in this pipeline? What are some of those tricks that kind of help people have success there in accelerating some of and amplifying those feedback loops?
You know, I think first of all, the organization has to be ready for it. What you're talking about is sort of a mature behavior where they're willing to share and understand. And I guess it goes back to somewhat to Chris's question, right? People are willing to have accountability for their areas, but they also want to make sure people can see the information coming from it. From a technology perspective, you know, we have products that do those types of things. And funny you say Accelerate because Accelerate's the name of the product. But what the goal of it is really to do what you said. It's to take information, and in this case, security information, and make it visible at a higher level so that everybody can see what's going on. And then that may affect what they might be doing and the decisions they're making. And at the top of the house, of course, then, you know, those potentially turn into go, no-go decisions for major releases or major funding or other initiatives, or how do I respond to some threat, those types of things. It's about making the information visible, right? No hidden work.
And one thing, I don't know if you've ever seen it in your experience here or even in another job, but quote unquote tampering with the evidence, marking everything as noise and saying, hey, look, I fixed it all. I'm awesome. Have you ever seen something like that in your travels?
Yeah, I think we all have. I'm just trying to... How do I say that without incriminating people? No, I mean, you're right. It's like, and sometimes it's intentional, and sometimes it's just like, you know, you see what you want to see, right? We all have kind of this bias, right, of what we might want to see. And it's actually, I think it's really hard just in general as humans to step back objectively and take a look at it and say, you know, what does this really mean, and take yourself out of the equation. It's hard. The more you can turn it into data and not a person, and look at data objectively, you know, with no personality, I think you can get there, right? You can say, look, this something's not right here, or these two pieces of information don't make sense. We need more, you know, we need to look at this more deeply. You know, the other thing though, and I guess what I used to see quite a bit was people, I guess it goes more towards the regulatory side or the internal regulations, like change control, things that you have to do. People will go out of their way to kind of avoid the internal regulations. They'll do more work to not do something when it could have been easier just to do it. And it, to me, that's kind of a cousin of what you just said. And it's like, you know what? Just do it. It takes you 5 minutes, but it took you 30 minutes to argue with me why you didn't want to do it, right? So, but at the end of the day, we can use our automation to make those things easier. You know, I like to kind of use, not that anybody is really buying it, but I try to use the terms benevolent governance or, you know, non-invasive governance or passive monitoring. With automation, though, I think we're getting closer, right? You can do these scans asynchronously. In fact, we used to do some of this. We would run a security scan because it takes a long time, right? And sometimes you have to build your binaries a different way. We'd do that on the side and let the binary go through, or the testing product go through for a while up to a certain point in the environments, because that scan was running for a long time over here.
Sure.
We would let it get to, for example, UAT and put a gate there and say, you can't go to prod with this until that scan comes back okay, and we can tag the code. So there are some things you can do to kind of speed up the process. At least you can get some more testing out of the way before you get the security results back. And so, you know, there are ways to do that without slowing things down. But at the end of the day, certain things just have to get done.
traditionally, I guess, being as part of security,
we
approach it and usually talk to a different part of the business first. We talk to the security teams first and then try to implement processes and hit this sort of negativity barrier that comes from the development teams. What are some of the things that that organizations can do to sort of overcome that? You know, because I know that frustrates a lot of security teams as they try to roll out DevSecOps or just security in general.
Yeah. You know, I noticed a while ago that if you're in DevOps, part of your role is to be a therapist as well. So, you know, the comfort that I would add to those security folks is it isn't just them, right? It happens a lot, right? The testers will get the same treatment from developers. It operations folks deploy people, release management. And conversely, it goes the other way too, where, you know, sometimes the developers need something and they're kind of getting ignored by others. So, you know, having said that, I think it goes back to one of the other core tenets of DevOps, which is empathy and collaboration. And you need to understand that we all work for the bigger goal of the organization. And that goal is to, whatever it is, right? Revenue, cost, risk, but to produce software, for example, that means something to the people we're selling it to. And we can't do that alone. And the security folks can't do it alone. And the developers can't do it alone. The developers certainly can't do it alone. They have to understand the security folks are there to help them deliver a high quality product that's safe for people to use. And, you know, other than, I guess the only advice I could give there would be, you know, try to put yourself in the other person's shoes. And if you're that security person, just keep wearing them down. I mean, I had to do that when I was, you know, trying to get people to use my service. I just wore them down. I killed them with kindness. And I said, well, what else can I do for you? Right. And they might be right. Sometimes, you know, when they would say, you know what, your service isn't as good as the service we built for ourselves. And I would look at it again, objectively, and say, you know what, you're right. What do I need to do to be better than that? And, you know, at that point they realized, well, okay, maybe you're serious about it. So we would work together on it. And so I guess maybe the only advice I could give their column would be, you keep trying, find out what they need, and then see if you can give it to them. Sometimes you can't. Sometimes you just have to say, you know what? Yeah. We can't do that for you.
Yeah, it brings up a really interesting point, though, Chris. And I think you may have inadvertently invented DevTheraOps now.
I like it.
We know that. Feel free to use that, right? We know, right, having talked to Gene and a few of the others, or the Jeff Humbles of the world, John Willis, those kinds of things, that one of the biggest determinants of long-term success with DevOps is the culture, right? That it ultimately comes down to people and process and tools obviously being a part of it, but the people factor. So I'm curious, as you've kind of navigated this a little bit, and you were talking about it just a moment ago, but how do we really start to build out that culture that where security isn't necessarily seen as the gatekeeper or, you know, the negative Nelly kind of coming and saying, hey, hold up here, we're all vulnerable, but really more of a business enabler? How do you think that we can kind of build a better culture around this?
Well, I think you just said, not that the two different things are wrong, but they're two distinct avenues. One was, how do we say security is an enabler? But the other one is, how do you get to accept it? Those are kind of two different things. I'll give you an example from a risk and regulatory standpoint. So for the longest time, I would go to the application teams and say, hey, why don't you come onto our, you know, platform? We can build it better, faster. You know, and they're like, they understood that we could do it better, faster, but the fact of the matter was they kind of controlled their own fate and they liked it, right? I'm asking them to take a leap of faith and trust to that I can build and deploy their code better than their best developer could. And that's a big leap because they're ultimately accountable for it. And so I would try, well, wouldn't you like to better quality of life, get home at 5 o'clock, you know, go coach your son's lacrosse game, all of these things. And sometimes they would say, yeah, that would be nice. One day by accident, I said, and by the way, you won't have to deal with audit anymore. And then I kept talking. And they're like, wait, what did you say? I'm like, what did I say? Words. Wait, that part where I said you don't have to deal with audit anymore? They said, yeah, what about that? I go, oh, yeah. Well, if you use our platform and we've built it in and we work with audit, and audit said, yes, you know, Dominus Nabisco, this is what we want you to do on this platform, then you don't have to talk to them. We'll talk to them for you. And in fact, I'll go farther than that. They can audit me. In fact, if they want to audit me every month, every week, I don't care, because you've already signed an attestation that you're doing things according to the platform rules, which kind of gets you off the hook. And that won it, right? Mm-hmm. And it wasn't that they didn't like audit or anything else, but at the end of the day, they kind of did see it as getting in the way of delivering. But I said, look, we'll take that away from you. and maybe that's at least part of the story with security as well. We say, look, if you let us do certain things with you, help you, we'll do it together, right? We're not going to do anything you don't want us to do. But if we do these things, you can do what we hired you to do. Go develop business logic or go engineer new platforms or whatever it is. We'll take care of this for you. Of course, we have to have some rules so we can, you know, make the right attestation. So maybe that's part of it. You know, and the other part of it is appeal to that higher empathy where it's like, look, we're all in this together. If we work together, we can make this, we have to do it anyway, right? It's not as invasive, but let's get it done together. It kind of goes to the point about MTTR, right? So you're like, oh, well, you know, if you think about how ops is measured, but they're compensated basically by having zero downtime, right? Developers are compensated in by doing what? Any ideas?
Writing code.
Creating change, right?
Yes.
Developers are compensated to create change, and operations people are compensated to have zero downtime. And what's the best way to have zero downtime? No change, right? So those are not compatible. And for us in IT to say we're going to have zero downtime, that's silly. It just doesn't happen, right? There's always something that can happen. So we've kind of shifted in DevOps to say MTTR. Now, that's a metric that everybody can get behind. We're like, look, we acknowledge there's going to be a downtime. There's going to be a failure. There's going to be something. There's going to be a security breach. What we need to focus on together is how quickly can we remediate it and how much can we limit the damage, the collateral damage. And so that type of, if you can also, I guess, align with the developers and say, what's the common metric or goal we can get behind? Now you're working on the same team as opposed to working against each other.
Yeah, it's interesting. We one of our earlier episodes, we talked around ransomware, and we talked about a particular organization that was taken down for like 5 days because of a ransomware attack. It does beg the question, you know, what sort of tolerances that you can really put on that, and you know, what's acceptable and what's not acceptable in terms of downtime.
That's true. And I think it always has to go back to, you know, what's the cost of compliance or non-compliance? It's always a business decision. I actually sat, I guess it was a couple of years ago now, I was invited to a sort of a risk conversation, security and risk up in New York, and senior level folks, you know, CISOs from, you know, AIG, things like this. And it was actually interesting to hear how they were talking about security and risk. They were like, we don't pretend it doesn't happen. We just have to decide how much we're willing to pay. And whether that means in avoidance or compliance or, you know, pay the fine, whatever it is. Now, you know, of course, probably the biggest problem is the reputation risk, right? You don't want to be on the Wall Street Journal for the wrong reasons. So, but it was always the conversation. It's like, you can't eliminate everything. Yeah. So what are you willing to bear?
And just to take it on a slightly different slant, the other thing that we've talked to a lot of people about is really the current situation that we're in and how business is changing. How are you seeing some of the changes happening to businesses that you work with based on people working from home, specifically DevOps, you know, working from home? Because DevOps to me is all about all being together, you know, and, you know, you think about Agile and Scrums and things like that. It's how do you do those sorts of things remotely and effectively?
You know, it's interesting you say it, because I think your lens of DevOps can be different. And when you're talking about the developers, and yeah, I mean, usually in most cases, they want to work together face to face. That's the whole idea of being together and doing Agile and stand up. When you think about operations and support folks, they're typically a decentralized group anyway. They don't work the same way. They still do DevOps work, but they don't have to do the same things developers do. And I think one thing to remember is when you think about that value stream, the delivery lifecycle, the front end is creative. And that creative piece are the developers. They're creating new things, right? It's very nonlinear. It's a creative process. It's face-to-face. It's brainstorming. The minute they check the code in, it becomes much more of a statistical process, right? That you need to, it is very procedural. And from there, because there is a degree of control after the check-in, it is DevOps, but it's a different kind of DevOps in a way, which is why things like SRE were invented by Google. It came from the operations side the other way. It doesn't mean there isn't chaos in operations. We know it happens, right? You know, just things you can't control, servers go down, whatever. However, from the point you check in the code, it's just a different way of looking at it. They can afford to be much more decentralized. And we've operated that way for a long time, support teams all over the globe. So the way you look at it kind of shifts as you go through it. Now, how does that apply to a current situation? I think a lot of developer teams at some level have been decentralized already. So it probably disrupted the routine a little bit, but I don't know that it did it a lot. The ops people, I don't know that it did it very much at all because they've always done that sort of thing. I think maybe the biggest change is there's so much more of it. Everything is virtual now. And, you know, we made jokes here as we started. It's like, you know, we're on camera. Remember that internally we are. Remember we see each other, right? You know, you forget these types of things. So I think that's part of it. But I think maybe the real other part, though, that's really that we're not seeing yet as an effect is the culture aspect, right? We relate better when we are in person together. And, you know, right now we're two-dimensional, maybe one-dimensional if it's only voice. And so that there's a lot that's lost there. There's a lot of communication and relationship. And so I think you have to really pay attention to that piece of it. And sometimes we get fooled, right? I can see you, but I'm still not getting all of the communication. And I think you have to really think about that. So given that DevOps is about collaboration, it definitely takes it down a notch when we can't meet face to face.
How does that relate to, say, some of the customers you've been working with? Have you seen changes in some of the ways that they're working specifically? I know our organization has coped really well with this, but I imagine there are organizations out there that haven't coped as well.
Yeah, I think, you know, we get to this point where we're technology bingo now. Well, you know, Rob can't talk, or I've got to reboot my router. You get a lot of that, right? You know, the network slows down. So, I mean, we deal with the technology pieces, the bandwidth problems, but I don't know that I've actually seen inside the companies that they're having any different issues than the rest of us. Mm-hmm. And how do you just generally deal with this? What I do think, though, is it's more things like projects are delayed. There's uncertainty, mm-hmm. right? So risk and uncertainty always creates, you know, kind of a pullback. And so, you know, in particular, funding for things is getting pulled or delayed. People are getting overworked. Maybe they're, you know, doing more projects than they used to. So there's that kind of a thing, which isn't really a DevOps problem, but it kind of is, I guess, because you just have to be even more empathetic about what other people are going through. I'll ask you guys a question though, right? So, you know, that's my view of DevOps. I do have a philosophy that DevOps means different things to different people, and that's actually okay. What does it mean to you guys? Like when you think of DevOps or DevSecOps, like how,
it's interesting.
How do you view the world?
We've been doing a play on what we call continuous security, and we've been doing that deliberately because what I typically see is that DevOps is one dimensional and not multifaceted. I mean, it's refreshing to hear you talk about governance and audit, but very, very few organizations that really do DevOps talk about that. They really are just talking about build automation and you know, how do I get this into my CI/CD pipeline? You know, that to me is one part of a much bigger picture. And you know, the real bang for the buck for me is being able to turn it back around such that you can influence, you know, so that you can pinpoint, well, you know, I've got five development teams. One is having lots of issues. You know, what can we do to improve that? You know, do we need to give them secure coding training? Do we need to, you know, how maybe education comes into it? Perhaps there's something in the frameworks that they're working with. You know, that not many organizations sit back and look at the data that comes from the process. And that's kind of what we're trying to, I guess, promote with this continuous security thing, is to try and make it something that's a little bit more like what continuous improvement is, you know, and bring that to a level that incorporates everything from governance to audit to, you know, all aspects of, you know, taking something which is a piece of code all the way through to the end, you know.
I mean, I come, you know, I'm a developer. So for me, DevOps really very much so means, you know, start to finish. I check code in and it goes through the whole gamut of stuff. And then we get to the whole, I need to do a push for release now. I go through a whole gamut of stuff there. And really, it's to me, it's like the if you could call it, I guess, the spine of the process. It's where things travel down more than anything else. It's not necessarily making choices or decisions. It's just, I'm going to do what you told me to do, but I'm going to do it so you don't have to talk to me.
That's actually part of the idea behind the Accelerate product as well. Is, again, we kind of talked about it before, but surface the information. when you have it, now you can start to look at where you're doing security at all different phases, but you also get the feedback loops and hopefully you can respond to certain things faster. So, you know, I love the whole idea of continuous whatever, whether it's integration or delivery or test or audit or risk or security improvement, right? It should be continuous. It should be just this information that you can tap into that's near real time at any time and look to say, how do I improve my piece of what I'm doing because I know all this stuff?
I'll just say, look, Chris, it's been great talking to you. Thanks for being part of this. Really appreciate you being part of the podcast and great insight into, you know, your world around DevSecOps, you know. Appreciate it.
Yeah, no, thanks for having me. I really enjoyed it. Security is one of those things I just honestly, not because you guys are here, but I think we need to think about it a lot more in DevOps. It gets forgotten. Problem. So thank you for this.
It gets forgotten outside of DevOps too. I mean, it's not much difference.
So that's probably all we have.
Yeah.
So all that's left to do is to say thank you, Chris, and thank you, Rob.
Yeah, thank you.
And we'll see you again next time.